Kristen Johnson is perhaps best known as the actress who played Sally Solomon on the TV show Third Rock from the Sun. Her fame was instantaneous, and its impact was to intensify her taste for alcohol and painkillers. After Third Rock ended, she was cast in a play in London where she had a medical crisis as a result of her addictions that almost killed her. She tells that story in her book Guts, which was published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Hi.
The book gives new meaning to the phrase, she spilled her guts.
I guess it does. Yeah, there are a couple of different meanings to it.
Yeah. And you want to apply both.
Yes, exactly. That's what I thought it was perfect. You know, it takes a lot of guts to tell the truth, I thought. And I don't care if that makes me sound like a obnoxious idiot. And of course, my guts exploded. So,
how close did you come to dying?
Well, I should have died. I really should have. A couple of doctors told me that, and then I was recently on the Dr. Oz show, and he said, you should have died. It's a, you know, acute peritonitis. It's something like even 10 years ago you would have absolutely died from.
What happened exactly?
Well, I enjoyed the painkillers and a little bit of booze, talking two bottles of wine a night maybe, but a really good wine. I... You know, if you take it painkillers consistently over years, it starts to. It's the actual pain killing, element is encased in aspirin, and so aspirin, of course, if you take more than 20 a day, which is what I was up to, it'll eventually burn a hole in your stomach. And so I had an ulcer, which I did not know I had. And then I was in London doing a play, and the play opened, and so did my stomach.
And as far as your pocketbook is concerned, you're lucky that you were in London.
We'll get
into that later.
I really was. Thank God.
The book focuses almost exclusively on your addiction and recovery. As a public figure, were you worried about exposing yourself?
I just gave everyone a heart attack. Anyway, I'm sorry. My career wasn't, it wasn't, it's just, I've always had the kind of career where it's never been hot.
Is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm speaking with Kristen Johnston about her book, Guts, The Endless Follies and Tiny Triumphs of a Giant Disaster.
Yes, sorry.
Okay.
Anyway, basically, I've always had the kind of career where, in terms of Hollywood, I've never been the hot girl. I mean, maybe I was for a minute. So I wasn't really ever worried about it affecting my career.
But you were getting jobs all along.
Yes, I was, but I was getting mostly, for a long time, just theater, which is what I wanted. I definitely wanted theater. I mean, after Third Rock is what I'm talking about.
Were the people you worked with before the accident all aware of the severity of your problems?
No. I mean, I think my friends could pick up on it. A couple friends were like, I'm worried about you. Something's off. But I was highly, highly functioning. You would never know. I would be sitting here just like this talking exactly the same. I mean, I wouldn't have written the book.
You wouldn't slur your words or anything?
No. I mean, maybe if, it was late in the evening but no, usually not that I'm aware of.
Well, I sometimes have seen celebrities on the late night talk shows and they look like they've had a lot more than they should have. And we kind of indulge them.
I guess so. Isn't it funny? Yeah. It's sad to me. But it's not just celebrities. That's the thing. It's not just Whitney Houston and Courtney Love and me and whoever. It's your mailman. It's your mother. It's your friend. It's your dad. It's your sister. It's when I go to meetings, it's not just actors. Trust me.
But those other people don't write memoirs, and
they do. They just have it written for them. Usually, no.
Well, the celebrities have it written.
Yeah, exactly.
Is this kind of self-examination part of the process of becoming sober?
Absolutely. I mean, has it? I don't know really what you're asking.
I'm asking whether you did this because this was a way of your getting rid of the past and moving on.
No, it wasn't with that intention. Although it has had that, had that effect for sure. I mean, it has really released me from so much and made me. Once you think of a certain event and you try to describe it as best you can, all of a sudden that becomes even fuller in your heart and in your head, and it's defined now for me.
Well, there's an awful lot of alcohol and drugs in show business. There was a time,
and everywhere.
But there was a time when it was assumed that almost every jazz musician was taking drugs.
Right. Well, most of that were. Right?
But a lot of that has changed over the years. Do you think everyone is on some level a potential addict?
I think everybody. I think everybody understands addiction in a personal way.
But most people are scared of it.
No, but what I'm saying is people can be addicted to Twitter, to MySpace, to their kids' successes, to the their lawn, to their car. You know, addiction is to golfing. You know, those golfers? Come on. That's addiction.
Yeah, but they're not going to find themselves in a hospital on the verge of dying.
No, but I'm saying is they can understand the compulsion. That's all I'm trying to say.
So you think it's universal, so this is not something that is the result of a genetic predisposition
up
in certain families?
No, I think mine's genetic for sure. I mean, my alcohol. I just think everybody's addicted to something. I'm saying alcoholics and drug addicts, I do think it's genetic.
What about your family? You sound from the book like you grew up in an economically stable, pretty happy family.
Great family. Yeah, I don't know. I've always been the mystery of the family.
Were you always funny?
Yeah.
Was that a defense?
I mean, if people think I'm funny, then yes, I was.
You are. I'm 6'1".
Yeah.
And you're taller than I am.
No, I'm 6 foot.
Oh, you are.
Yeah.
Are you wearing heels or something?
No, no. You just didn't get up when I came in, you rude man.
I did, actually.
You did the half stand.
Anyway, but still, were you tall when you were very young?
I was. When I was 12 years old, I was this height. I was 6 feet tall. It was horrifying. Horrifying.
So I'm assuming you told jokes and were the class clown
just to deflect.
To protect yourself.
Exactly. Because, you know, if you tell joke... That's the whole thing about telling this story in the book, because if I tell it, then like the Inquirer is going to be like, well, that's not a story. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's so much better to tell it than it to have it be revealed, you know?
Do you think that the same experiences that fed your addictive predilections inspired your ambition?
Yes. Very good question. Without a doubt. I think they are hand in hand.
Your brother was also the target of bullies.
Yes.
Because he was tall?
No, because he was a violinist. And he was different. You know, he was sort of a smart violinist.
So...
he was like a wunderkind. I mean,
so any kid is different, you're saying, is going to be a target.
In my school, it was.
Where'd you go to school?
In Milwaukee.
Oh, well, okay, that explains a lot.
But it was a Catholic grade school. It was very, very, very sort of, you know, oh, my God, Stacy, if you don't wear that sweater, you know, that kind of thing. There was a lot of judgment.
Your parents actually took you to
And some lovely people, by the way. But sorry, keep going. Sorry.
Well, there's a lot of beer in Milwaukee.
There is that as well.
Your parents took you to a doctor to see if your growing that tall was normal. Yeah. And what happened?
Well, basically, they took a couple x-rays. They thought I was going to be a giant, literally, because I was 6 feet tall. I mean, it was horrifying.
And you never thought of playing basketball?
Well, I tried, but I'm a klutz, so that didn't work out. But me standing up from the bench would literally make the girls run, so that was fun. So I had the intimidation factor, but I didn't have the skill, unfortunately.
You thank your one of your tormentors in the book as an inspiration.
Yeah. Actually, that tormentor, Amy Grable, that is a character that is two different girls that I mushed together.
But do you think that they'll recognize themselves?
No. I mean, I hope not. I don't want them to, you know, because like I'm sure they've told their kids, like, we were great friends, or, you know, who knows? And I don't really care. I don't hold any animosity towards them. They were kids. I hold animosity towards their parents for not raising them right. But I got mine with her.
You got your revenge.
See. Yeah, in the book, you'll see. My revenge.
You also got revenge against the tormentors of your brother by punching him out.
I kicked the biggest bully in the shin when I was way, way younger, and I was much smaller than him.
So when did you start drinking? Were you a typical teenage drinker?
Yeah, I thought I was. I mean, I thought I was typical, but I don't think I was. I would drink to blackout in high school. I would slam, steins of stuff like as for fun, like, "Oh, look, I can slam this," of like hard liquor. And so I didn't realize it. But I wasn't – all the rest of my friends weren't always throwing up or always blacking out, but I was. So – but then it curbed down like a lot when I got to NYU, just in terms of my ambition sort of took over. And good ambition, not like Eve Harrington ambition.
You were in the theater program at Tisch.
Yes.
You're kind of an icon in parts of the gay community.
Oh.
Did that start when you were there?
No, actually. Well, kind of. I mean, I guess in a weird way. I met this guy named David, and David Pitou. He's a brilliant New York actor, and he's been nominated for Tonys up the wazoo. And he is still to this day my very favorite stage actor. But he was the first man to ever tell me I was beautiful. He was the first man to introduce me to, like, Douglas Sirk and, just cool, great, and going to see – I remember going to see Charles – Vampire Lesbians of Sodom with him, and just understanding like the kind of subculture, I guess. And then I did a play a couple years later where the gays started to, they started to line around the block to see me in it.
So when you saw those Douglas Sirk movies, did you imagine yourself in the Lana Turner role?
Or? No. No, I never did, actually. I think if I was in the 30s right now or what, 40s, I think I would want Eve Arden's career, I think I like those kinds of parts.
The wisecracking friend.
Yeah, or Rosalind Russell or something like that. But I would never want the, like, pretty lady parts.
So you did a lot of theater. How did you land on Third Rock?
Actually, I was doing a play at Lincoln Center called The Lights. And it was a brilliant role, and it was my first real big break. And one of the producers from Carsey Werner, who did Roseanne and, all that stuff, they came and saw it for some weird reason. And he said, we're developing this show about aliens with John Lithgow, and, like, in a year and a half, you'd be perfect for one of the parts. And I was like, mm-hmm. And, of course, a year and a half later, I happened to be in L.A. I had just gotten fired from a TV show, from a pilot, and which was devastating because that's why I had moved out there.
Not unusual.
No, of course not. And, it just – the show wasn't funny, so they were like, let's fire the not famous person. But anyway, so – and so I was there, and I went and auditioned. I auditioned 8 times and finally got it.
And you do a funny riff on the other people they were looking at for the part.
Well, they kept – every time I left the room, I'd be like – okay, that's mine. Now, seriously, that no one can laugh harder. That was brilliant. That was great. She was me. And they would be like, my agents would say, they love you. They really are. There's an offer out to Kirstie Alley. And then they'd say, the next time I'd go in and I'd nail it. And then they'd be like, there's an offer out to Ellen Barkin. And then finally they were like, we want you to come in yet again for the 8th time. And I was like, maybe you should see if Queen Latifah is available because I can't go in there anymore.
But the success really was a double-edged sword. Is that when you started taking Vicodin?
Yeah, Vicodin, yeah.
Vicodin.
Oh, you're so cute.
Well.
Vicodin, right.
Sorry, I've never taken it.
That's cute. Clearly,
I have
you're
taken
not,
some aspirins.
Yeah, of course. You've taken one or two. Here's the thing. Vicodin is the first thing I had was here's where I think anybody can be an addict. When there is a circumstance like losing a loved one to a terrible death or something like that mixed with access. In other words, you also have migraines at the same time. Okay. So if those two events cross each other, I think anyone could become an addict because they kill pain. They're painkillers.
But you were trying to kick when you went to London to appear in Love Song.
Well, that was
after.
Years later. Yes. Yeah. Many years later.
But then it got worse, partly because it was so easy to get.
No, it didn't get worse. See, by that point, I just was staying sane. See, there's a point where you're no longer taking it to feel anything. You just want to be normal. You don't want to shake. You don't want to be craving, so you just take enough to make the monster quiet. So I took, when I got to London, I realized they have codeine and aspirin there, which is a way much milder form of Vicodin. And so I took like 40 of them. And then I'd be like, okay, now I feel fine. It was horrifying. And of course, that I already had the ulcer because I was already having terrible heartburn. I mean, agonizing. And then the night after we opened, it ripped.
Well, this is not a story about healthcare reform, which is a big topic in this country. But let's talk about your hospital bill for one moment. How long were you in the hospital?
Well, yeah, I'm not a girl who like cares a lot about that stuff. And I care now because that was amazing. I was in the hospital for 2 months. I had an 8-hour surgery, a few very serious procedures, tons of medicine, tons of morphine. I'm just kidding, morphine. And you know, after all that, 2 months of that, and I mean, literally, I was calling my business manager, going, "I don't know, sell this, sell that." I didn't know what to do because I didn't think it applied to me. And I got the bill, and it was £2,000.
Okay, that's
for
about
2 months.
That's a little over $3,000.
Over $3,000
in the United States. It would
at
have
the
been
time, yeah,
$40,000, $50,000, $60,000.
Oh, knows, I somewhere. Thought it would be a million. I didn't know.
Right now, you're in your second season of TV Land show The X's.
I'm about to start shooting it in a month. Yeah,
and you're going to be giving
it's
a
in
talk.
June. It's in June. Sorry.
You'll be giving a talk and signing books this Wednesday at 7 o'clock at Book Court in Brooklyn, and then at Thursday at 7 at Bookends in Ridgewood, New Jersey, and then later in March 28th at the NYU Bookstore, April 2nd at the Barnes & Noble
well,
Store.
You know what they could
All
do?
Of those are on our show page at WMSC.org.
Oh, good. And also, if people are interested, can I say my website?
Of course. Okay.
GutsTheBook.com, and it has all the appearances that I'm going to be making and the talk shows I'm on and blah, blah, blah.
And meanwhile, there is this book called Guts, The Endless Follies and Tiny Triumphs of a Giant Disaster, published by Gallery Books.
Simon & Schuster, yeah. Gallery
and Books. My great thanks to Kristen Johnston for
Thank
being
you,
on our
Leonard.
Show today.
I appreciate
we'll see you, on
you having me, really. Thank you so much.